accession number 27058, reel 9.
This is the fifth reel of a taped interview with Rob Ulrich in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 31st of the 12th, 2003, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Rob, I wanted to talk to you about actually going to Yugoslavia. We'd started to speak about it before. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the actual process.
Well, when I first joined 6th Squadron, they were firstly at a place called Foggia, which is in the south part of Italy. But just after I joined, we moved to the eastern coast of Italy to a place called Termoli, which is just slightly north of the spur that's on the bottom part of the eastern coast. And Jasper, the CO, just after I joined, told me to hop into a Hurricane and go and fly around Yugoslavia and just have a look at what they call Tiger Country.
You talked about that earlier.
Yep.
What about the actual process of getting there?
Well, I was taken by a bus from the little town of, the little village of Portici, to Naples Airport, and I forget how I went across to Foggia, but I just went to, somehow they got me to Foggia. Then when I told Jasper that I liked the sound of what he explained to me about the squadron's operations, and then we went to Termoli, then he said fly over the country and have a look at it and then come back and just make up your own mind what you're going to have to do if you ever get shot down. So shortly after that I was made a flight commander, because this was the second tour I'd done, so nobody else on 6th Squadron had ever done a tour, so I was made a flight commander. And shortly after that I was told that they were going to send a detachment of the squadron, which is a part of the squadron. And he said, you're going to go as officer commanding. So we all flew across, and a couple of DC-3s came across with all the equipment that we needed and the tents and so on. And we staked out an airfield just behind, or slightly to the east, of a very, very large city called Zara. Today it's called Zadar. I don't know why they've changed the name. But it was a very comical situation, really. Did you ever read any books of Biggles in your younger days? Well, we were more Biggles than Biggles was Biggles. We were very lucky in a way. We were given a job to do, and we were left to get on with it. We weren't bothered by anybody. We had a really delightful AOC, Air Officer Commanding, Sir William Elliott, a very small chap, an Englishman, to his boots. I think he was part of the English aristocracy. He was a very pleasant old gentleman. I think he said he was 83 once, and he'd been retired for about 40 years. But he said, they've plucked me out of my retirement to come to this most heathen of all bloody heathen countries, and here I am sitting on a bloody rock in Yugoslavia eating stew from a tin plate. There's got to be more than this in the RAF. And he rambled on a little bit. Quite a nice chap, actually. And he'd often give us targets, but not always. He'd say sometimes, this is very important, should have been done yesterday, make it first, came off the rank. Right. But other than that, we received targets two or three times a day from wandering Yugoslavs. Everybody who was in Yugoslavia at that time was a partisan. Those who weren't partisans were Chetniks. The partisans knew we were working with them to help them succeed in their one aim in life, to get rid of the Germans who were invading their country. And they did all sorts of things to help us. They went out of their way. They were marvellous. About that time, the British government had given the Yugoslavs about 35 or 40 fairly early model, fairly clapped out Spitfires. And, of course, then they trained a few of them in flying. And, of course, those 40 they trained, or 35, they were the absolute elite of the partisan forces. They were just, you know, so very pleased with themselves. And the chap who was leading the Yugoslav squadron was a fellow called Karl Simic. He was a commissar in the Partisans, which is a fairly senior rank, for which he got no pay at all. The RAF, in their infinite mercy and wisdom, had made him a pilot officer, which he got 8 and 3 pence a day for. But he was a very fine bloke. I was just 22, and Carl was probably in his 40s, I think. They had no air discipline at all, but my God, they weren't frightened of anything. They would do anything to kill Germans. And we used to get targets, I'd say 2 and 3 a day, from partisans who just wander in. Now, we were in the middle of a hell of a big area of flat ground. The nearest town was Zara, which was about 8 miles to the west. And how these partisans ever got to where we were, I don't know, because they didn't have any transport. Carl had a jeep, but only because he was a commissar and he led the Yugoslav squadron. But nobody else, other than other commissars, had vehicles. The only way they could get to us was occasionally there'd be a horse or a pony, or sometimes there'd be a very, very old push bike, otherwise you walked. But they'd come in and they'd gabble away, and in a language, of course, you couldn't understand. There were at least, I think, 200 to 250 different languages in Yugoslavia, and there are umpteen dozen dialects, so your chances of being understood were pretty slight. You had to make do with sign language, which, you know, you can say you want something to eat, or want something to drink, etc. But I had absolute control of our detachments, and I could pick and prioritise targets which were given to us. Carl and I had a rough system. One day of the week he'd make the decisions, and the next day I'd make the decisions. Or if something particularly important came up, we just discussed it together, and then whoever was next to fly would take the job. But we found that they were marvellous with us. They used to give us endless supplies of free drink. Hoo, hoo, hoo. There was always a bit of a lottery in the drink they gave you, because not one bottle, and I've seen many, many hundreds of bottles given to our little units, not one bottle ever had a label on it. So you weren't quite sure what you were getting. Quality, I don't think, was given much consideration. You knew that what you were getting was a freebie, that was a good plus. It was to be highly alcoholic, it was another good plus. There was plenty more where that came from, and there's another plus. And some of it was very, very, very nice, and some of it was terribly, terribly potent. I can remember one morning, the bloke in charge of our security, our guards, we had wandering around at night just to make sure that nobody got in to damage the aircraft, woke me up. I think it was about 2:30. And he said, "I'm sorry to wake you, sir, but I've got a jug out here. He's got a piece of a map and he's jabbering away. I can't understand a word of what he's saying. So I gather, you know, you'd like to see him." I said, "Oh yeah, once we're 2:30 in the morning, wheel him in." So they brought this fellow in. He was quite an elderly chap and he was rugged up. You wouldn't believe how cold it gets in Yugoslavia at night time. Very hot in the day and freezing at night. And this had about a square foot of an old map, and he kept pointing to it and saying, "Tedeschi, Tedeschi, Tedeschi, Benzina, 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 Voy Bomb, Voy Bomb, Benzina, Multi, Multi, Multi." Well, Tedeschi is a word which meant German, and Benzina, of course, is petrol, and Multi means there's a hell of a lot of it. And he kept on pointing to a little part on this bit of a map, and Donc Dupont, who was an English major, very, very, very fine bloke, old dog, magnificent bloke. I think he'd be dead these, because he was in his 40s in those days. And he was our intelligence officer. And I said, "You've got a copy of this one, Doc?" And he'd look at this, "Yeah, I can find one." So he came back in a few minutes with a brand new map of the Yugoslav, jumped up and down, and kept on pointing to a little bay. And he said, "Benzina, Benzina, Benzina, Tedeschi, Tedeschi, Voy Bomber," which means you bomb. So I said, "Right up." So I sent one of the blokes to wake up 3 other pilots and to tell the cook we'd be taking off at about 6-ish, and we want a very good hot meal, and that was it. So we all had several cups of tea and a nice early breakfast, And we took off from where we were just behind Zara, and the place that this chap was talking about and pointing to was a place called Yablonuts. And as far as I know, it's just a small hamlet. I don't know whether there are any big buildings. When we got there, we were in and out as quickly as we could, and I didn't see anything but this bloody big fuel ship. So we took off and went down south for quite a distance, low on the surface of the water, to avoid being picked up by a radar sweep. Having gone a few miles south, we did a 180-degree turn, which brought us to the west of a line of probably not mountains, but fairly high hills called the Biblic Mountains. And I told the other three to stay below the level of the mountains. And every now and then I'd pop up for just a minute to have a look and see where we get down again. And when we got close, I said, stand by. I got level with this bay where the ship was located, and said, let's go. So we all turned left. And they must have had every bloody gun in Yugoslavia. We only just crossed the line of the mountains, way up or the hills. And we were subjected to very, very, very heavy flak, everything. 40 millimetres, 20 mil. I'm not sure they had any 88s, but they had plenty of ordinary small arms ground fire, which can do just as much damage. For some reason I'm not sure of, I turned out to be a very good shot with the rocket, which has got its drawbacks, because if a job's coming up and they say, oh, it's an important haul, my bloody ass, oh, good, send on it. And every additional hour that you spend in the air, you increase your chance of getting shot in the bum like a garden sparrow. So I suppose the attack lasted, less than a minute, because we just dived in as deeply as we could. I fired my rocket first, and I hit the ship right in the middle. Of course, you don't see what's happened to your own rockets, because, unfortunately, due to the physics of the situation, if you fire your rockets here, by the time the rockets get there and have exploded, you're just there, just above it. We lost a few pilots like that in the early days. They just didn't develop an act of how to do what was called a split-ass turn, right or left. As soon as you press that button, you do a mad turn either right or left, so that when the explosion is there, you're there or there, and going like hell. But I climbed up over the other side of the bay and then dropped down on the water, because we were told by ballistic experts that it's very difficult to fire accurately with any gun which is in a depressed elevation. Well, I don't think anyone told the bloody Germans, and if they did, they didn't believe them. And we were about 5 feet above the water, going as hard as we could back to the city of Zara. And I looked behind my shoulder, and there was flame and smoke about 8,500 feet high. I've never seen such a big explosion in my life. It was a fairly large ship, and as far as we knew from the pilots, it was filled with petrol. Now, the bay was down here, and the walls ran up like that, rather like the top of a funnel, and then there was the level landmass. And they had no mechanical way of getting the fuel from the ship to where they wanted it to go. So it was all been manhandled by troops, I believe. And the Yugoslavs let us know later on. I was by that time shot down on an island. There were about 9,000 or 10,000 people who were incinerated, and there's just one big crash. But as we were going on very nicely, I had about 34 pounds of boost and about 3,500 revs, which is very good, and that magnificent Rolls Merlin engine. And all of a sudden it stopped like that, just stopped dead. Now, there are only two reasons why an aircraft engine will stop. One is fuel and one is electronics. So mine just stopped dead, so it obviously wasn't fuel. So when I was making that dive into the ship, obviously a small bullet, a 9mm or a 7.6mm, somehow got into the engine and must have clipped or just broken an electrical lead from somewhere to somewhere else. So as all our work was low level, our aircraft had about 1 ton of extra armour plate on it. The engine was encased in, I think, 3/8 armour plate steel, and it ran along the bottom of the aircraft about 6 feet behind the pilot's backside. And of course, it's about 3 or 4 feet with engine stopped and the aircraft weighing something like 9 tons. I couldn't get enough height to bail out. The people from the parachute company, Irving, as it was in those days, used to come and see us every now and then and give us propaganda lectures. And the one thing I always remember them telling me, if you're clear of the aircraft by 1,000 feet, a parachute will save your life, not necessarily save a limb. And I had no chance of getting to 1,000 feet, so I just had to land on the water, which is called ditching. And I suppose I was doing about 160, 180 when I hit the water, and the rate of deceleration is unbelievable. 1 minute you've got some sort of fly characteristic, the next minute you ain't. And of course, with all the weight in the engine, it just stood on its nose and went straight down. Under the pilot's seat on the right-hand side was a huge red handle, which somebody told me was the hood release breaking something. And they said, if you ever have to ditch, pull that damn handle. So I pulled that and I could feel the tension, and the extra pull was supposed to break or cut the pins which held the hood on. And I said, oh, well, the hood's got. I pulled it back like that and the hood's gone, so that's all right. And as soon as it hit the water, the hood flew forward and jammed shut. And I said, oh boy. Luckily for me, in those days I was a fairly good swimmer, fairly good surfer, not board surfing but body surfing, but I used to be a fairly good swimmer. So I said, oh well, I have to get rid of this. So I grabbed the two handles on the inside of the hood and pulled it. Nothing happened. And I said, oh dear, oh dear. So I remember I gave it three more very hard tugs. Didn't move an instant. Of course, all the time, the aircraft's on its nose and I'm going straight for the bottom. And I could see little bubbles of air going past me, flashing past. And three hearty tugs and nothing's happened. So I said a little, small, quick, fervent prayer, believe it or not. I put my feet up on the instrument panel and grabbed and heaved, opened as though it was on greased rollers, which of course it was. So I got out. Now, I don't feel the cold, but that time I was freezing. Of course, I was probably scared as hell. And I was down so far, everything was absolutely black. But I knew if the aircraft was going that way, the surface was that way. So I kicked out to go to the surface. Now, that's the only thing, that's the last thing I remember in the water. The next thing I remember, I was floating on the surface. And we used to wear a yellow thing called a May West, which had a little gas bottle down here, and once you broke that, it would inflate up here, and particularly under the head, it had a large bubble in this May West which kept your head out of the water. So to operate the gas cylinder, it's something that you almost cannot do accidentally. It's too firmly fastened. So to do that, what you've got to do is to pull a little tab here of silk, and that opens the very, very tight press stud, which is about the size of a shilling piece. And having done that, you get the handle of the little gas cylinder and do that breaks the neck off. And in about a second, there's a whoosh, and you feel this great buoyancy. Now, it's almost impossible to do that accidentally. I don't remember doing it, but on the way up, I must have knocked myself out on the tail of the aeroplane, because that's the only thing I could have hit trying to get to the surface. And the tail of the aeroplane was made of 3-ply and fabric, and I suppose the front end of the tail was probably about that wide, so I must have hit my head on that. And I didn't come to until I was on the surface, but even today I don't remember doing it with a CO2 bottle.
Were you a religious man?
I was at that time, very religious. But
what was the prayer, do you remember?
Yes, I said to the good Lord in his infinite mercy that this was my second tour, and I'd had a few close shaves during the past other tour, and I'd had a few close shaves with Six Flags, and I said, for heaven's sake, I don't want to die like here like a bloody rat in a bloody wooden box. And then that opened unbelievably easily. Oh, so I got my RFD, rubberized fabric dinghy, which is a small thing about 5.5 feet long, and they put that in a little pack that they put on the parachute. But if you undo your parachute, the RFD stays under your backside. So all you've got to do is bring it to the surface, undo about 12 or 16 prestos, then open this bright yellow rubberized fabric dinghy, get the CO2 bottle, pull a pin out and just turn the knob, and it's got gas, and CO2 bottle about that big and about that diameter. So the dinghy filled up.
It's quite a big cylinder to be carrying around. It's about 12 inches by 3.
Oh, filled it by 2.5 certainly. But I put it, it can be a nuisance because they put it right in the front of the pack and it's right under your legs, and it can send your legs to sleep and give you pins and needles. But when you realise the important role it's there for, nobody argues too much. So I got the dinghy inflated and I scrambled in. And in those days, all pilots or all aircrewing had to wear what were called sidearms, some sort of revolver. And they'd given me a long-barreled 38 caliber Smith & Wesson, which I couldn't hit a barn door if I was locked inside for a month. I only carried it for moral support. But I got in the dinghy and looked around to see what was happening. And I could see a little rowboat coming towards me, and I could see three people standing in it. But that was a long way away, and I didn't know who they were. And in those days, there were four groups of people who wandered around Yugoslavia. There were the partisans. If they caught you, you were very well looked after. If the Chechniks, you had 50-50 chance. There was a group called the Ustashi, and they were just brigands and lawbreakers, and they killed people for the joy of killing and raped and murdered and plundered. And the fellow who led that was Andre Provin, I think. He died recently in Spain, but he was a war criminal with a huge price on his head. And who was a fourth group? Oh, the Germans, yes. If they caught you, they'd just shoot you for dead. You wouldn't worry about it. And I was talking to an English soldier one day, and he said, in this part of the world, Robert, the position is what we describe as militarily fluid. And I said, well, good. What's that in plain English? He said, no bastard knows any other bastard is. And these four groups just wandered all over the place, and nobody had any idea who was where. So these three people were coming to me, and I had no idea who they were. And I thought, well, if they're Ustashi, I'm dead. They weren't Germans because they'd been in uniform, and these blokes were in sort of rough old country clothing. And as they got closer, I saw they were both very elderly old men and one very young girl, about 15 or 16 years. So they pulled me out of the water and said, voyancora, which means you alone. I said, yes, only me. Just why me? So they said, in broken language, take all your clothes off, we've got some dry clothes here. So I said, righto. So I took everything off, and when I got to my underpants, I pointed at the little girl, and she just looked at me and said, oh, no, I couldn't give a bugger, so I took off my underpants. And they
so
gave,
she refused to turn around?
Yes. Oh, she was only 15 or 6, she gave me a big grin. And they gave me a pair of trousers that must have been designed for Bob Hope or Charlie Chaplin in the early days. They were black and white checks, and each check was about 2 inches by 2 inches. Luckily, they did fit me, that's the only thing. Then they gave me a shirt, and they rowed me back to the little island called Love Sea. I didn't know where we were, couldn't have a clue. But they looked after me. They gave me some food, and they gave me some drink, and made sure that they'd look after me until they got me back to my own base. In those days, the Americans had given the Yugoslavs what were called transceivers. They were fairly portable little radio things about that, by that, by that. And they would could receive and they could receive and send. But they had a limited range, only about 35 or 40 miles, I think, under good conditions. And the partisans had worked out a very cunning system that they would transmit for about 5 minutes, twice a week, from the highest hill possible. And they relayed a message from one group to another group to another group back on the beach, and told me that they'd found me, and here I was. And I got a message back that they were going to send them an SAR, sea air rescue launch, to pick me up. These sea air rescue launches were bloody beautiful. You ever watch McHale's Navy? Well, that's what they were. Some of them had two aircraft engines, some had three. And boy, they could go. I remember that I must have gone down very, very deeply, because I had sore ears for days and days and days. I think it was 8 days before they collected me. And I had sore ears. The problem was with partisans, they never had anything as sophisticated as doctors, medical officers, medical orderlies, no first aid at all. So there was nothing they could give me to ease this. It was quite painful too. So when the SAR picked me up, which was late at night, because if the Germans saw an SAR, once they'd be after it to destroy it, because it was obviously going somewhere, to help somebody. And when I got on board, very late at night, and I met, he was a flight lieutenant, can't remember his name, I was his 159th rescue. And they had little badges painted on the side of the ship's cowling, little flags of people they'd picked up, and they said, oh, you're the 159th, you're Australia. Yep, oh, good. And I said, have you got a doctor or any medical fellow here? And they said, yes, we've got a sick bay attendant. I wasn't quite sure what that meant. He said, what's the problem? I said, I've got bloody sore ears. He said, oh, don't worry about it, we'll fix it in a minute. Just satisfy, which is Egyptian for wait a while. So we pushed off into the night. And with the Dalmatian archipelago and the Dalmatian coast, there are two fairly clearly defined passageways in the water. They were called the Podgorski Channel and the Planinski Channel. They were only about a mile wide, and there were no lights anywhere, no lights at all, no navigation lights or anything. And this bloke said, everybody on board, we're off. And he threw the throttles open, and off we went like a bloody mad thing. And we were doing about 40 knots, not a light anywhere. And there were bloody islands all over the place. And in the Dalmatian archipelago, the islands range from about that big to the size of Tasmania. And we're doing 40 knots in total bloody darkness. So, Jesus, hope this bloke knows what he's doing. And he said, Oz, I forgot. You're sore ears, I'll fix it. So he pressed the bell, And a voice came over the radio, yes, sir. And he said, let's have two buttered rummers as soon as possible. I'd never heard of buttered rummers. But I thought, oh, sounds all right. So about a few minutes later, a great bearded fellow came up with two porcelain cups about that thick, about that deep, rather.
About 6 inches.
Yep, and about 3 inches in diameter. And they smelt very attractive. So I drank one, and I thought, oh, that's all right. And this fellow said, you'd like another? Yes, please. Two buttered rums. So, and what a buttered rum is, you get a quantity of boiling water to which you add a very considerable slurp of rum. Then you get a tablespoon of butter and you stir it in. And when the butter's completely dissolved, that's when you drink it. It's not bad either. I think I had four of that. After that, I couldn't give stuff out of my bloody ears. But he said, go below and get your head down, mate. We'll wake you up before we get there. So I just went below. All the ear problems had vanished. I think I just vanished too. I just fell into a bunk, and the next thing I know, we're at beach, time to get up. So there we were.